You're listening to Masters of Web 3, presented by Transact. Join your hosts, Sammy Start, Transact co-founder and CEO, and former CNBC Money journalist Megan DiMatteo, for an exclusive look into the stories behind the world's most well-known Web 3 startups. Each episode, we will interview the high-profile founders, developers, and innovators building the world's most widely adopted blockchain protocols. Hear the highs and lows they've experienced along their journey from the people behind the tech that's changing our world. Let's get into the show. Make it as easy as possible for mainstream users to buy crypto within your decentralized app or wallet. Onboard more users to crypto, handle higher transaction volumes, improve conversions, and increase revenue through a simple developer integration. To learn more, visit transact.com. That's TRANSAK.com. Welcome, everybody. Today, we are sitting with Harry Kolodner. Am I pronouncing your name last? Last name right?
Okay. Perfectly.
Harry Kolodner, who is the co-founder and chief technology officer at Offchain Labs, where he leads the engineering team. And as I'm sure our listeners know, Offchain Labs is the company, I guess you...
Yeah.
It's a company, yes. Right? Not a yeah. DAO that's behind the Arbitrum ecosystem. Welcome. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
And we also have Sammy Start, our Transact founder, co-founder, yeah.
Co-founder.
And we are sitting here at a studio that's off-site at the Permissionless Conference. How are y'all enjoying your time here so far?
It is a blast. Like, the level of excitement about the ecosystem is just, like, everywhere. And kind of, I think, you know, for us it's been particularly exciting kind of the number of Arbitrum users that have come up to us just to, you know, tell us how much they love using Arbitrum has been kind of amazing to me, considering the fact that we're just now sort of emerging from this COVID bubble where nobody was really sort of meeting each other and seeing each other in person, and emerging into this is just the best experience.
Yeah. I walked by the Arbitrum booth yesterday and I literally, like, I'm an introvert, and I literally was like, oh my God, like, so many people, like, energy overload.
If my voice is a little hoarse, it's because I've been talking a lot.
Yeah,
I know. Well, that's, like, one question that I want to ask for today's conversation is, like, why does everyone love Arbitrum? Like, everyone loves Arbitrum. So, like, and your shirt even says, no, I don't know that people can see it on the video, but your shirt literally says, I love Arbitrum. So I'm like, that should be the title of this episode. Sammy, how are you enjoying your week?
Yeah, it's really great. It's great. I was just speaking with Harry before, and it's, like, really good balance between a lot of, like, dev and product people, while still having a bit of the corporate side, but not too corporate, you know? And you know, it's really nice. I think we've all been working really hard the last couple of years, like, building our product heads down. So it's nice to kind of come out and see all the users, all the developers who are like in our ecosystem, and have some real conversations. So I think it's been really nice and very energizing few days.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe the two of you can talk about this. Like, do y'all have a moment where, like, you're walking through the expo and you see a booth and you're like, wow, like, I remember hearing about that company, like, 5 years ago, and, like, it was, like, this idea, and now it's here. Like, does that moment happen for you all? And I'm sure you have personal relationships with these folks, too.
It's funny. It's, like, for me, it's, like, a combination of, you know, some of that and then some of the polar opposite. So some amount of, like, oh, my God, like, there's just so much, you know, new emerging stuff that exists today that wasn't here, you know, a month ago. And so, I mean, I think, you know, and both are just incredibly exciting, of course, because, like, you know, both the fact that we have sort of, like, these long-term participants who have kind of, like, you know, really sort of, you know, made it through, you know, ups and downs of the crypto space and are here and succeeding, along with kind of all the new energy and new ideas being brought in, since, of course, like, where we are as an industry, like, we need to keep growing, we need to keep, you know, bringing new people in, new ideas, like, there's a long road ahead, and kind of growing the industry is the most important thing there.
Yeah, and for me, you know, reminiscing back to a couple of years ago when we were at DEF CON in Osaka and like East Denver and all of the projects, but they were just kind of bunch of co-founders, right? Or like very, very small teams, like less than 10 people. And it was all very casual. And I won't embarrass anyone in particular, but I remember going out for karaoke with like two of these teams and they're now like both kind of multi-billion-dollar companies, you know, and so it's really good to see kind of everyone kind of evolving and growing you know, as leaders,
and
as companies, and
having singers. Like,
yeah. Well, I don't know about. We'll have to go for a round two, maybe. Yeah, and see that. Yeah.
That is so cool. I love that. I'm like, I want to know what everyone's go-to karaoke song is now. Like, if you want to spell that T, please do.
I mean, I can do some good Backstreet Boys. So. Just putting that out there.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I'm gonna hold you. Like, I'm gonna remember that. Yeah. If we ever get the chance.
Let's see.
Harry, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I cannot sing. I am not. Oh God, no.
Which is orthogonal to how much fun it is, right?
Well, that's fair. Yeah. No, that's very. But I just wanted to add on top of what you were saying. Like, I think, you know, the one area that, like, to me, sort of like is sort of like everybody has been here forever, which like is near and dear to my heart, is the scaling teams at like kind of the. Because it's really like amazing kind of in, you know, there are certainly side of some newer, you know, some newer entries, but like so many of the L2 scaling teams. I mean, I love to say like we had like an Arbitrum booth and a Matic booth, now Polygon, right next to each other in so many conferences. And no one coming up to us because no one had any idea who we were for so long.
Just two kids at their lemonade stand.
And it's just kind of, you know, it's just, you know, so amazing. And it like, you know, really sort of like, you know, the fact that like all the, you know, founding teams of like, you know, the major Ethereum L2 projects kind of like came up together in the environment where basically no one cared about scaling at all because no one was using it. And everyone said, well, why would we care about, you know, why would anyone spend energy on scaling when no one cares about it using it at all? Yeah. But you know, it took a very, very long time to get here. So it's a good thing that people cared early.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, we're going to dive into layer twos for sure today. I know that's a big topic, especially with like the Ethereum merge that's happening and, you know, like all of the different trends that are happening in that world, you know, layer twos versus layer ones. There's a lot meaty conversation to be had there for sure. Before we dive into that, though, I want to ask the two of you what your first, I'm trying to ask every guest this. What was your first crypto purchase and your first crypto wallet? Take us back to that moment.
Oh, God. I mean, I think my first crypto purchase, I think, was buying ETH on Coinbase.
Okay.
But like I was like relatively late to the like, I was relatively late to actually buying crypto.
Yeah, what year was it?
2016 maybe.
Okay.
But I was doing crypto stuff since 2014.
Yeah, because that's when you started building Arbitrum.
Yeah, and it kind of, there was a long period of, no, that was not when I, that was like, I was a PhD and we can kind of get into this more, but I was working on, and I wasn't even doing Ethereum stuff. I was doing Bitcoin stuff back then. So I had a short period of time at the beginning of my crypto time where I was kind of much more of a Bitcoin person until I, you know, saw the light. But for a long time, I was kind of like very much like, this is very cool from a research perspective, but like, I don't really like thinking about money at all. But like, I love the technology. And I kind of gradually sort of like moved more towards like, you know, well, as assets, these things are also amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. That thing, that whole finance side of it for sure. Sammy, what about you? Have I asked you this before?
I don't think so.
Okay. What was your first crypto?
And it's actually the same, exactly the same answer. So it's ETH in 2016.
Okay.
From Kraken though. And I just heard about it from a few friends. And kind of looked into it, and then I bought ETH, and then I also wrote a smart contract, like a very basic ERC20, and just deployed it, and I just had this really weird moment of like, where is this code running, right? Like which server is this? And then you kind of look into the answer to that, and you're like, oh, there isn't a server, you know? It's running everywhere, and I really kind of looked into it from first principles, and then I went kind of quite all in and just like got really convinced.
I love that. I had a similar feeling when I minted my first NFT. I'm not a serious NFT artist. Like, I mean, I mint NFTs because I find them interesting and I write poems, and so I put a couple of his NFTs, and I had a similar feeling. It was like I minted it and then it was like, wait, what was that? Like what did I just do? Like it was similar to like waking up in the middle of the night and walking through your apartment without the lights on. I was just kind of like, I don't know where this is landing. I don't know where this is going. I don't know what I'm holding on to. It was like totally new foreign sensation. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine why that was appealing and why you guys got sucked in. Okay, cool. All right. So, yeah, let's go into Arbitrum. Let's go into the company background. This is a question I ask because I used to be a kindergarten teacher. If you had to explain a layer to roll up to a kindergartner, how would you do it? Harry.
Can I do like first grader instead?
Sure. Assume they know how to tie their shoes already. Sorry.
No.
I didn't prepare Harry for this question.
No. I mean, I will do the simplest kind of that I can do. And like, you know, that involves, I think, you know, skipping over a lot of details. But the fundamental idea and kind of it all has to start from understanding Ethereum. And from the, in the Ethereum blockchain, you have blocks being created. Those blocks have a certain capacity for transactions. And kind of as that capacity gets filled, there's, of course, you know, a market that emerges. It becomes more and more expensive. And so there's a huge incentive to basically do more using less. Kind of, can we become more efficient so that we can not have to pay these prices, so that we can fit more transactions? Yeah. And rollups really try to solve that problem. And the fundamental idea behind rollups is that essentially we're going to take as much as possible and not do it on Ethereum. So rather than, this is kind of very much not first grader, but it's essentially the difference between using Ethereum for everything and using Ethereum for settlement. And so essentially, rather than actually running your transactions, you're just using it to sort of checkpoint and agree on the overall state of something running outside of Ethereum. And that's what we do with, that's what the rollup space is we have this idea of sort of a separate blockchain that looks a lot like Ethereum. But rather than having a consensus mechanism like proof of work or proof of stake, where you have a set of nodes that are effectively sort of voting in some way, voting with hash power, voting with stake, instead you have a system where there's a blockchain, but there's no consensus. It just settles onto Ethereum. And so Ethereum itself actually provides sort of is the security of the blockchain, as opposed to having kind of a set of validators or miners.
Okay. All right, cool.
That was not good for kindergartners.
gifted kindergartners.
Yes. Yes. Sammy and I were talking about this yesterday. I used to teach at a school for gifted kids, so
yeah.
I'm sure some of them would understand that.
Yeah.
Interesting. So as you were talking, I was getting the visual of like a go-kart track. But then, like, every time you go around the track, you have to come back and pay a ticket, you know, to get back on the track. Is it kind of a similar, like, thing where the activity is happening off of Ethereum, but then you come back to Ethereum, like you said, to validate it?
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting, actually. Like, every Arbitrum transaction is an Ethereum transaction, quite literally, in that, like, the data that is sort of the Arbitrum blockchain, like, a blockchain is a collection of blocks, a block is a collection of transactions. And so essentially, kind of, if you think about it that way, all Arbitrum transactions actually are posted on Ethereum. Then, of course, the question is, well, how is it any cheaper if you're doing everything on Ethereum? And the answer is that only the data, only the inputs, which are enough to sort of define the chain, because everything is about kind of what is the result of running these transactions, goes to Ethereum. And that is significantly cheaper than the actual execution of those transactions. And so at all times, these transactions are still directly going back to Ethereum, getting their security from Ethereum. And the only thing you're kind of moving away from it is kind of agreeing on the result of those transactions.
Okay.
But every node in the system, anybody who's watching Ethereum can know exactly what it is. So you don't need to sort of ask somebody else or introduce new elements in order to sort of know what the state of the chain is. You just go to Ethereum itself, which is kind of a really powerful property.
Could you maybe give like a simple calculational computation or like a series of computations and then say like how computationally expensive would that be on Ethereum and how much on Arbitrum, and like why is that delta there? Like what does that actually come from? Like maybe something like 2 + 2 = 4 or something like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say like kind of generally speaking, kind of called so and with this kind of that gets to one point, like the cost of doing the computation isn't actually reduced per se. It's moved. Mm-hmm. So instead of Ethereum kind of bearing the cost of that computation. Instead, Arbitrum bears the cost of the computation. Mm-hmm. Since Arbitrum essentially is just its own chain from the perspective of actually sort of executing it as a node. And so that kind of, you're not like, there's no magic. You're not removing it. You're just moving it to a cheaper environment. And so I would say kind of the call data tends to be sort of a tiny fraction. I wish I actually had a good number off the top of my head, but like a very small percentage of the cost of, let's say, a Uniswap trade. The vast majority and the most expensive thing on Ethereum is called state access, mm-hmm. state reading and writing. Mm-hmm. I know you know this, of course, but...
This is getting really deep now, right?
Yeah.
This is getting really deep, yeah.
And so like kind of things like state access are the things that are really expensive. And math is actually itself is actually relatively cheap. And so the savings from moving math off is not that exciting mm-hmm. when it's sort of simple addition. But kind of advanced cryptography, where you're doing all sorts of complex mathematical operations, or systems which are kind of most blockchain smart contracts where there's a lot of state that people are interacting with, since state is really the method that different people coordinate with each other, because it's the thing that lives beyond the lifetime of your transaction. It's the way that your transaction has an impact on the rest of the system. And those things are expensive because anyone running a node needs to remember all of those things and know about all of those things because they need it to execute future transactions. And so that's the part that's kind of the by far sort of the biggest contributor to cost, which is really exciting to move away from Ethereum.
So it's kind of like you're storing the state in a separate environment that's cheaper. Yeah. You're doing the computation on a different environment, which is also cheaper, at least for now, right?
Yeah.
And then you're rolling up the information that needs to be rolled up back to Ethereum when it needs to be rolled up. Right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's a great description.
Love it. Great work. Great teamwork, everybody.
Yeah.
So you said that you didn't start building Arbitrum in 2014. That's when you started doing blockchain stuff. Talk to us about like when you started building Arbitrum, what was the biggest, I guess, pain point that you saw? And then, you know, how dApps are using it now.
Like, yeah.
And maybe tell us what your first big dApp was too that came on board.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's interesting. So Arbitrum, actually, the idea behind Arbitrum actually was come up with in 2014, just not by me. So one of my, there are three co-founders of Offchain Labs, myself, Ed Felton, and Stephen Goldfeder. Ed Felton was at the time a professor at Princeton. He's now retired since he's been full time at the company for quite a while. And Stephen Goldfeder and I were grad students. Stephen was a year above me. The idea behind Arbitrum originally came actually as an idea. There was an independent study class at Princeton. Where different teams were working on ideas. And Arbitrum was originally an idea that Ed came up with, like as a suggestion for a class project. they didn't get the whole thing built. And it looked a little different. It certainly, you know, there are definitely differences from where it is today. But like the coolest thing is you can go on YouTube and you can Google, if you search for Arbitrum, you'll see a video from like, I think from 2015, which was the report that that team did at the end of the semester. And you can really see sort of, you know, yeah. It
should be in a museum.
Yeah. I'd like to see that, yeah.
Or on chain, I guess. Yeah. Get an NFT.
NFT.
I'm not sure if anyone has.
If you're listening.
And then you can give them all like sunglasses and hats and stuff. And,
oh, my gosh. And Princeton t-shirts.
But yeah, so we had this class project and then kind of, The thing that happened then, and I remember I was in the class at the time. I did a different project. I thought it was really cool, but like some of the other people jumped on it first. So otherwise I might have been working on it then. But the thing that happened next was that Ed left Princeton for a while since he joined the Obama White House as the deputy CTO.
Does Obama know about blockchain? That's the question.
That's crazy. Yeah.
That's a good question. at some point, you might need to talk to Ed about that. I know he has some, I mean, obviously there's some stuff he can talk about and some stuff that he can't, but he certainly, you know, he has some pretty crazy stories from his White House days. But essentially he left and the project had dropped. And I should say, by the way, 2014, this was actually pre-Ethereum launch. Mm-hmm. This was when Ethereum was kind of an idea. And I think it was in a way kind of obvious that Ethereum, if it ever got adopted in a serious way, would have scaling issues. The core Ethereum team themselves knew it. They were already thinking about ETH 2.0 back then. They just knew that the amount of work to get there would be large. I don't think they imagined it would take as long as it has.
Yeah.
But I think they knew that basically they couldn't wait for that. They had to ship.
That's actually a question that I wanted to ask you as somebody who's leading, you know, the teams that are building these. And Sam, you can touch on this too. Like mm-hmm. when you're – there's the balance to be had, right? There's a balance to be struck, especially in like a really bullish startup environment where you want to bring things to market as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So you want to create fast solutions, but then you also want to hold the long-term vision as well. And so how do you kind of strike that balance when you're building tech? And maybe we'll start with Harry and then move on to Sammy.
Sure.
That it's a tough one. I mean, I would say that kind of the place you don't want to compromise is in security. The place you don't want to compromise is sort of creating risk for your users, since kind of keeping users safe has got to be the top objective. I think the place kind of you can and certainly like do compromise is sort of ease of use and performance, where essentially kind of as you sort of go on the journey of onboarding users and kind of growing the project, you know, you have time to polish. Mm-hmm. And you know, you really in a way kind of there's a lot of value in having your early users be the people who can kind of see past the, you know, the awkward edges.
They're like the family member that has to love you, even if like, you know, you wake up on the wrong side of the bed one day or like, you know, you have braces. Yeah, they love you through your awkward braces phase.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there were compromises on like, you know, they already, you know, they knew, you know, there would be issues with proof of work mining. They knew, you know, that there would be issues with the EVM itself. And there were, you know, multiple iterations on top of the EVM through Ethereum hard forks after that. But those were things that were sort of, you know, were okay given the context that like kind of what they were building was kind of a serious blockchain that kind of they could have confidence would work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sammy, do you want to touch on it from the Transact point of view, which is crypto, sure. You know, crypto on ramp? So slightly different, but
quite
related.
Quite different, I think, in terms of the adoption and product. One thing I would share with you that I respect like hugely that you did is that you're kind of starting a product like well before the adoption curve, and that's like, you know, that's like chewing gravel, right? Because that's really really tough to like believe in that and to like keep sustaining that hard work. You know, those long weeks and sacrificing personal life when you don't even see the adoption yet, right? So I really respect that, like especially from 2014. That's crazy.
Thank you.
Yeah. So kudos for that. But for me, when I started working on what is now Transact, I actually initially started working on onboarding just for kind of financial applications. It wasn't even necessarily to do with crypto. And it was just kind of how do you get money into apps? How do you kind of verify identity and get users on board? And then because when I started working on that in 2018, dApps weren't really a thing, right? And then in early 2019, this is a real Reddit post, by the way. I posted on Reddit paying 0.1 ETH to speak with dApp users. Real post, look it up, like Sammy Start Reddit, like this exists. And back then 0.1 ETH was like $20 or something, you know. And I spoke to a few people who were using like Axie or CryptoKitties or like MakerDAO, right? And I made a stipulation, no devs, you know. It had to be people who were using it just for the sake of using it, not for like intellectual curiosity.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And I had some pretty weird conversations, not gonna lie. But I also had some like very good quality conversations. And at the time, the market size was very small. You know, it was as compared to now, it was like basically nothing.
Like, was it basically just Reddit users?
it was like very niche people. But I had a conversation that really stuck with me, where I spoke to a guy. I think he was from Texas, and he was a construction worker, had absolutely no technical background, and he was just playing blockchain games, and he just enjoyed them for the sake of playing them. Right?
I want to talk to that guy. I want to bring him here.
Yeah, I wonder. Like, I could probably find the trail and like find him.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't spoken to him since then, right? I just paid him his 0.1 ETH, and that was it. But I mean, like from a first principles point of view, that gave me the confidence, because I had already, like 2 years prior, as we discussed, mm-hmm. I had already like deployed the smart contract. I was already sold on the idea that this is like the new internet. It kind of gave me the confidence that the adoption is starting.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. And so I kind of started building into that. But 2019 was tough. I'm not going to lie. It was like it is coming, but like when, you know, and like how much, and like,
And how do you motivate yourself? Like the both of you, like how do you motivate yourself whenever, cause it's somewhat easy when the adoption is here because there's urgency. Right. And so it's like, you have to build it. Otherwise someone else is going to do it. But in those moments where you aren't getting that validation, like how do you motivate yourself and keep the vision, you know, for in the forefront of your mind every day?
Yeah. So for me, it was just like, that year it was just grinding. Like it was just like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take a swing and just grinding. But then the moment when it started getting easy, it was actually in DevCon Osaka in like late 2019. Right. And I started working with Yeshu then. And we joined the Consensus Accelerator, and that conference, I met so many other people who were working on it, and I just felt like not alone anymore.
Yeah.
I felt like there were other people who were working on this, and I felt like I'm not crazy. Like this is really like a thing, you know. And they were also like my kind of people, you know. They were like very intellectually honest and very like interesting people. And I was like that's the moment when it started to become pleasurable. Like it was always fulfilling, but that was the moment when it started to become pleasurable, and like it started to flow, you know.
That was for me. That's such an important distinction, fulfilling versus pleasurable.
Yeah, happiness and pleasure is not the same thing. Yeah.
yeah, and satisfaction. I think every entrepreneur can relate to that. I mean, I'm not a blockchain developer or a founder, but I run a freelance writing business and I'm self-employed. And I've had, you know, I can relate to that experience where you're like, I'm doing this because it's fulfilling something in me and it's important to me.
Yeah.
But then whenever you find other people who are doing it, you're like, my people!
Yeah.
Like, you can just kind of like... I don't know, the validation. Validation is important. I think people.
And also like working with Yeshu, like his work ethic has like always been so insane. And that's just like, it's just inspiring, you know, like it kind of, it pushes you as well. So that was another thing for me. Yeah. What about you, Harry?
Yeah. Hey.
Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely kind of the way it started. And I think for me, the way that's kind of really pushed it through is just like, I think what we do is so cool. Like in a lot of ways, like I'm just like,
you love Arbitrum.
Yeah, like I'm just like, wait, this is my life. I get to like do this. Like,
yeah.
Oh my god.
I would have done this anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like when we first, like especially like, so I mean, we, and I think I kind of started in, but then I didn't really sort of like get it, you know, continue sort of like the background, like kind of we, after Ed got back from the White House, Stephen and I walked into his office kind of remembering the, when we had worked on this, when he had kind of presented the idea originally, and kind of, you know, we, Stephen and I were both like, this is the time, like it is now. I mean, it wasn't really the time, but at least it was the time that like you could really see things coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in, I think, late 2017, maybe. The dates are, I'm like, my brain for dates is always a little fuzzy. Maybe 2018, early 2018. And we worked on a research paper because like we weren't really thinking about like, you know, starting a company. We were academics. We were like, this is, you know, a great contribution. And so we worked on that, and then kind of we sort of, you know, somehow talked ourselves into, none of us had really like, I mean, Ed did like a little bit freelance, Ed had done some freelancing, but Stephen and I hadn't done anything kind of entrepreneurial. I had never really like thought about being an entrepreneur before.
Mm-hmm.
But like, we really loved the idea and wanted to work on it, and kind of like magically, you know, found amazing partners at Pantera Capital who led a seed round for us. And so we kind of got funding, and it was sort of like that sort of like most magical thing where we had money, we could eat, and we could like, you know, just like be there building.
Yeah.
And it was sort of just the most exciting thing.
I actually want to talk about that. So we're getting close to the end. I want to close with the two of you talking about OnRamp with layer twos.
Yeah.
But my, I guess, last question before that, wrapping up the founder's journey concept, is like, when that money came, when that moment came where you realized, I have to become a founder and I have to raise money. I can't, I mean, obviously you're so excited because you're like, I get to do this, but you also are like, oh, I have to like see myself in a new way. I have to become a professional. I have to become a person who walks into rooms and talks to investors and commands a certain level of money. And,
mm-hmm.
And also like, I don't know, have the ability to receive that kind of money, that is a big transition that can happen really rapidly, especially when you're in the flow and you're following like your passion, right? Like that moment can sometimes seem like it happens overnight, and then you have to kind of see yourself in a new way. So what was that moment like for the two of you? We'll start with Harry. Yeah.
For me, it was definitely sort of just more like responsibility, essentially, like just like feeling kind of more and more sort of like carrying on my shoulders, sort of like, you know, like people, funds, sort of, you know, that like I, you know, have this sort of like deep feeling of, I mean, it's, you know, I don't sleep enough, and it's because, like, you know, I you know, owe so much to our, we have kind of, we're a tiny team. We're only, I think we just reached 30 people, but we, wow, like, it's like the 30 most amazing people
idea.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, I just, like, you know, feel like, you know, I just, like, owe so much to, like, those people. And, like, that's kind of, I'd say, you know, above all else, like, that's sort of, like, you know, both, like, you know, the biggest weight I carry, but also the thing that, like, you know, gets me the most excited.
Yeah.
Because there's sort of no other choice. Like, it's the sort of thing where kind of like as you grow, and it's sort of like, you know, you blink and you're in a new phase. Like, yeah. It's kind of like it really snuck up on me. It wasn't something that I really sort of prepared for. And I'm sort of like constantly in like a new phase.
Did you have a day where you were like, you just went off grid and found yourself like belly up at the local dive bar, or like did you have to like give yourself pep talks in the mirror, like, did, you know what I mean, like how did you, because I feel like, you know, it's like the lottery syndrome, right? When people win the lottery, right? It's uh-huh. like suddenly they have a new identity, suddenly they're a yeah. millionaire, so it's like uh-huh. suddenly you're a founder.
Yeah,
how do you keep your cool and emotionally yeah. process that?
I don't think anything happened suddenly for me, like okay. everything was always sort of like I looked up, because like I'm so heads down that I like look up and I notice like, wow.
Yeah.
Like we just doubled.
Yeah.
We just have like twice as many people as we used to have. Like
yeah.
in my head, we're still at like six people. Like, you know, I'm constantly actually sort of behind mentally where we are
yeah.
trying to catch up. But at least it's sort of like, you know, it means that it's sort of like a gradual, it's always sort of a gradual adjustment for me. It's, I have never kind of hit this sort of like suddenness. It's always sort of, you know, just, you know, you know, accelerating, but like yeah. continuously rather than in jumps.
And if you're holding that long-term vision the whole time, then it just seems like a natural outcome, like a natural consequence of everything you've done. You're mm-hmm. like, okay, cool. We've arrived.
In a way, like a lot of times, like I need to sort of like remind myself like where we are, and to like kind of like, I'm very bad at smelling the roses. Like I'm very bad. Like I'm like so tunnel vision yeah, on same. Sort of. Yeah.
Same.
Like that's the amazing thing to me about like being like going from like, you know, 2 years of just like being holed up at home during with COVID, and like coming down here and like talking to like people who are fans of Arbitrum, like actual people in the real world who love Arbitrum. Like that's like yeah. not something I get to experience normally. And it's just like the best that. Thing ever. And it really sort of like pulls me out. So this conference has kind of just been a great sort of like, wow, experience.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
What about yeah. you, Sammy?
Yeah. I guess I kind of had my existential crisis before Transact.
Oh, good.
Right. So I kind of got that out the way. And I think we were actually speaking a little bit about that last night.
Yeah, yeah.
But I kind of got that out the way, and I think that what I realized is that I would just enjoy the journey, right? I wouldn't try to be anywhere, right? Because you never get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you whenever you try to set an aim, you never get there. And then I remember when Yeshua and I kind of deployed Transact and started getting the first users, there was this moment where we had it connected to our Slack channel. So we had a Slack channel and the orders would come in there. And there was this moment where I could no longer manually see every order that was coming in because there were too many orders, right?
Oh, man.
And that's kind of what they call product market fit, right? It's like you kind of,
oh, yeah.
the market is pulling the thing from you rather than you, because before that it was a grind, right? You were just trying to like get something out
yeah.
there. But at that moment, I've never like questioned what I was doing because I'm just too busy trying to like serve what needs to be done. Right. Same thing for you. Right.
Absolutely.
Harry?
Yeah.
Like there's just so much demand that like, it's like you're running from a bear or something. You don't question like why you're running from the bear. You just run, you know?
Yeah.
And so, And so, but of course, there have been challenges along the way, right? Like, and I felt the same thing, like Harry, like every like 3 months, my job changes. We spent a lot of time actually with very, very small amount of employees. It was like December 2020, we had like one employee basically, right? It was like me, Yashu, and one software engineer. And then over the last year and a half, we've gone to like 108 employees. So during that time, my job description has changed drastically. I've gone from like managing a few people to like managing people who manage people. And in some cases, like people who manage people who manage people. And so like it's been a big journey, but I kind of have enjoyed solving new puzzles all the time, right? It's at no point has it been repetitive or the same. So I'm thankful for that. You know, I wouldn't have it any other way. So.
Yeah, you get to stay growth oriented.
Absolutely.
I'm very happy, very thankful, and I love it. Yeah, and I agree with Harry. It's nice to have that kind of gratitude and like smell the rose a little bit and be like, wow, this is actually really cool and really aligned with what I wanted to do. So yeah, this is a nice moment of gratitude, I think.
Let's take a moment, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
If you're listening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Take a moment and feel grateful. I do think, this is my personal opinion, I do think that there is an inverse relationship, I think that's how you would describe it, to the amount of gratitude that you can feel and the amount that you're capable of achieving. Like, you have to, I think, have a big enough space inside of your heart, inside of your body, to feel gratitude, and then that directly translates to how much you're able to do in the world. That's my personal opinion. It's an equation.
Nice.
Okay, let's end with the conversation about on-ramping for layer two specifically. Mm-hmm. How do people get on Arbitrum? It's through a bridge. And how are they on, like, how are they buying crypto in the process? Like, what's that process like? Where do you see it going?
I should probably take that, right?
So, go for it, Sammy.
I think that when we started the company, the infrastructure layer was like being solved, right? And then I see another layer on top of that, which is like the DApp layer, which is like your Uniswap, your Aave, your Axie, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then There's another layer on top of that, which I call the distribution layer. I don't know if that's the best term for it, but that's actually taking those smart contracts and like putting them in the hands of real people and actually getting adoption beyond the kind of tech elite, so who like understand like how to like set up all these crazy wallets and stuff, right? So, in that onboarding process, there's several challenges. There's like setting up a wallet. There's actually buying crypto and putting it in the wallet. There's bridging that crypto to Arbitrum or whatever network that you want to be on. And then you actually have to execute the transaction and in some cases pay gas fees. And so and then there's also like identity pieces in that as well. So I think that what we're trying to do is to try to allow people to buy crypto directly on Arbitrum so they don't have to go through all those extra steps.
That's 12 steps.
Exactly.
13.
And in a dream world, like actually go directly into a DeFi position on Arbitrum, right? Because we're thinking UX here, so we want it to be as little steps as possible. And so how much can we solve on the back end and how much compliance can we take off the apps? And ultimately, like, we want to enable apps to do that. We don't want to be like the AOL of Web3 and like try and do like everything. We want to kind of enable and empower people to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much? Do you want to touch on that before I ask another question?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just sort of on the Arbitrum perspective on like why this is so important is that kind of fundamentally kind of we see the world, and I don't see any way this is not the world where we're kind of. To the degree that layer twos are sort of the main thing people are using, users will come direct. Mm-hmm. That going through Ethereum and kind of if you want to use Arbitrum, there's no world where you want to pay for the fees on Ethereum in order to use Arbitrum.
Yeah.
Like that's not.
Yeah.
Ethereum's future users will be users of layer two scaling solutions. Mm-hmm. That will become what it means. People will just, you know.
Wow.
I don't know if they'll say where I'm using Arbitrum. They, you know, they might even just say, like, you know, it might be even become synonymous with using Ethereum, essentially, in the kind of extreme case. Because Ethereum is just, you know, as the value of Ethereum space increases, fundamentally kind of everything other than valuable settlement will be priced out.
Mm-hmm.
And where the rest of the activity will go, which is sort of the people who care about like, hey, I have some cash in you know, I want to convert it into crypto and use this dApp. None of them are going to be able to use Ethereum.
Yeah.
And so like what you guys are doing is just so critically important.
Yeah. Because if you play it out like to its kind of like 5-year conclusion or 10-year conclusion, yeah. Like if the thesis is correct that like, you know, you have the layer twos built on top of Ethereum, like Ethereum will become very, very computationally expensive, right? So yeah. it'll be things like balancing budgets between like sovereign states and like, you know, like really like doing transactions between banks and like really big transactions will be there, right? And so like doing consumer on ramps in theory, this is like way kind of futuristic, right? But in theory will be totally like it may be laughable one day that you would want to do like a consumer like $100 on ramp to Ethereum.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I mean there've been periods of time where it was already laughable.
Yeah. Like DeFi summer, right? It was like $50 gas fee, and then the transact fee would be like $1, and you'd be like, oh, come on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Y'all just blew the lid open on a lot of things that I've been writing about and the retail side of things, because I write for a lot of personal finance publications, and we talk about Ethereum as though it's a retail investment. As though it's an investment that retail investors might be interested in. So. Yeah, you just threw a whole wrench in that form of logic.
But short term, that might be valid. Yeah.
But the cool thing about Arbitrum is like when you use Arbitrum, you pay fees in ETH. Like
yeah.
ETH, the asset, is like very much sort of the foundational component of Arbitrum.
Yeah.
And so like from a kind of commercial perspective.
It's going to have value.
Yeah, like that. And kind of since all Arbitrum transactions are posted to Ethereum and pay Ethereum for the security that Arbitrum has, it's sort of very, very fundamentally kind of integrated. Like the position of ETH only gets strengthened by rollups because the value that you can get from what ETH provides you just goes up and up.
Yeah. That said, this is not investment advice.
No, absolutely.
This is not financial advice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Interesting. And currently, as it stands now, through the Transact integration, you can onboard with ETH and USDC onto Arbitrum.
Yeah, straight from fiat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about that process or?
So it's a developer integration, right? So you can put the Transact widget in an Arbitrum app, and then that will allow the developer to onboard their user from fiat right into a Arbitrum native asset, and then they can use whatever Arbitrum app that is, whether it's DeFi or game or DAO or whatever it is.
What are the most popular Arbitrum apps?
That's a good question. I think there's a whole kind of amazingly large ecosystem. Like in terms of native projects, kind of some of the biggest ones are GMX, DopeX, Treasure DAO in the NFT space. There's also kind of a large number of kind of projects that have kind of migrated have gone multi-chain and are deployed both on Ethereum and on Arbitrum. So SushiSwap, Uniswap, for example, really sort of actually the vast majority of sort of the main kind of Ethereum DeFi ecosystem has deployments on Arbitrum now. And so that's kind of one of the cool things for sort of users migrating is that you don't need to sort of learn a whole new ecosystem. You can find kind of the vast majority of the dApps you're already used to also on Arbitrum.
Okay.
And you have all the security of Ethereum like built in straight from the start, right?
Yeah. It's a no-brainer. If you're not on Arbitrum yet, come on. What are you doing?
Join the club. Amazing. Well, thank you both. Well, thank you, Harry, for your time.
Yeah.
This was so much fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. I'm enjoying it too. I love being here. I love learning. Yeah. I love the space because it's so growth oriented and you can just ask all the questions and it never gets boring.
Yeah. Always changes. Yeah.
Oh God. Occasionally I wish it was a little bit more boring.
Yeah.
That's the truth. You heard it here.
You've been listening to Masters of Web3, a Transact podcast.
Stay connected with us by subscribing to the show, giving us a review, and sharing this episode with one of your friends on Twitter. We know you hang out there. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. That helps us to keep delivering the best and latest stories on blockchain technology right to your ears. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this has been Masters of Web3.